Welcome to the RAQA Cafe, a conversational podcast with a couple of hosts that spend each episode talking about regulatory affairs and quality assurance topics. NAMSA is happy to bring the RAQA Cafe to you, where each episode features NAMSA consultants and their experiences. Be sure to visit NAMSA at NAMSA.com for more information and access all podcasts and transcripts. We hope you enjoy today's episode.
Welcome to the RAQA Cafe, a NAMSA MedTech podcast. On this episode, we sit down with two of NAMSA's experts on the IVD regulations and discuss the impact of the recently announced EU IVDR extension. For this conversation, we bring back Warren Jameson, the Senior Manager of Regulatory and Quality from the EU. And we also introduce you to Christelle Perrin-East, a Senior Regulatory Consultant from our IVD group. During this discussion, we focus on what the IVDR extension means to the industry and provide information on why it's necessary to keep pushing forward with compliance and registration to the new European regulations. We thank you for listening in, and we hope you enjoy this recording of the RAQA Cafe. Well, thank you guys for joining me today on the RAQA Cafe. We've brought Warren back for a repeat. So, you know, you were so successful with your first podcast, we had to bring you back for more, or we just have a topic that we needed your expertise in. And Christelle, you're a first time attendee to the podcast. So I hope you enjoy yourself. I love doing this, and it's always great meeting my coworkers. For me, this is what I tell everybody. This is kind of my water cooler moment, you know, since we're not in the office anymore and we can't just walk up to somebody's cube and talk about the things that excite us about our industry. Now I get to do this podcast where I get to talk about exciting topics, at least for me. And, you know, hopefully it's informative to our audience. So, Christelle, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Warren, welcome back.
Thank you so much.
All right, Christelle. So, you know, this is the RAQA Cafe. I always try to make the first question, you know, what are you drinking today?
So it's afternoon here for me. So I'm not actually drinking coffee because otherwise I can't sleep at night. So. I prefer herbal tea, and right now I'm drinking an infusion of French verbena that I grow in my garden.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
That's amazing. That I feel terrible now that I'm holding my store-bought coffee.
I do like a Starbucks coffee, too, sometimes. Yeah.
You know, in the last podcast where I had Matt Royal and Paul Risbro, I asked them, I'm like, so, you know, what's the English version of Starbucks? And they said Starbucks, so. They've pretty much taken over the world, haven't they?
Yeah.
At this point. So, and Warren, what do you have today?
I am actually on juice for a change. I'm trying to drink a little bit more fluids than coffee and energy drinks. It's probably not a good sign. My wife recently said to me, he's like, how can you drink so much coffee and go to sleep? And I'm like, I don't know if that's something wrong with my brain or coffee's not effective anymore. But yeah, I'm trying to cut down my caffeine a little.
I have to know, what is your energy drink of choice? Because with four kids and three teenagers, I'm well-versed in all the different options there are out there these days.
I think Monster probably has been, as a nearly 40-year-old, probably showing I should not be with the kids anymore and that kind of thing. Yeah, I just a caffeine fiend, three or four cups of coffee a day, can have a couple of those and then I lift weights and stuff, so pre-workouts probably got a lot of caffeine, like 200 milligrams of caffeine in a shot of that. It's a lot in a day, and I can still just go to sleep. As Christelle says, you know, she's up all night, whereas I could be like, oh, midnight, I'm tired, I'm going to go to bed now.
And so my oldest son is a workout fanatic, so he's 19, he's in college, and you know, the gym is his escape. And like, yeah, I was looking at his pre-workout, and I'm like, you know, this is like four cups of coffee and like 10 ounces. That's you probably need to keep an eye on that. But he's so disciplined. But like, you know, eating for me is a passion. Eating for him is just fuel for the workout.
I think before COVID, I ate a lot better, exercised a lot more. And I think over the last few years, I've gotten the ruts out trying to make my way back out of it. Even though, as you can see from the screen, you can't see behind. I have a bike right here, within touching distance, a Peloton of all things. Ooh. And I think this week's been the first time I've been on it in about a year. It has been a lovely paperweight and clothes hanger. in my office rather than actual usage. So other than that, it's all good.
You know, there's no judgment from me. We won't even get into my...
I judge myself every time I walk past it to go sit at my desk to go to work. Every single day.
Well, so, Christelle, I'm so fascinated that, I mean, I have a lot of plants in my garden. I grow native plants, and I know that there are plants in my garden that I could harvest into tea, but I've never trusted myself to do that. So, I mean, so do you have a tea garden specifically, or?
No, verbena is quite easy to grow and it's fairly safe to use. So it's nice. And otherwise, no, I've just got some leaves for cooking, like thyme and things like that. Very basic organic leaves for cooking.
That's great.
I've got a very small garden, so I would like to do more, but I've got too small garden.
My father was in this conversation right now. You and him would just... And I'm an only child, and I think I'm the disappointment when he looks at my garden, which is just grass and some trees. And like you, he has peaches and apples and strawberries. He's always growing something. And he's coming over to me, oh, I'll help you with your garden. Just looking and going, no, because I'll have to maintain that. And I won't. So I think you and him would probably just absolutely love, because he's like a pond in the garden with koi carp fish and stuff like that as well. So,
whoa.
You know, so he's garden themed. That's how I've grown up. And then he comes to my house and looks at the depression of just grass and patio.
Well, I was looking for a good segue into our conversation today, and you brought up maintenance. So let's talk about maintenance now. I mean, the reason we brought you guys on is, you know, the IVDR has been extended. That's, you know, that information is several months old now, but I'm sure there's a lot of people out there wondering what it means, and I hope listeners that are calling in aren't cheering in excitement that they, you know, that they can put it off more, but are cheering in excitement that they've got more time to make sure they keep their product on the market or have their strategies developed for getting new product to market, or, you know, help them make their decisions on what products need to be updated and which ones can hold off on being developed. You know, it's a lot of work. So I think you two are a wonderful guest to talk about the IVDR and its extension. And, you know, we'll probably go over some highlights again of, you know, what you need to do to become IVDR ready. So I guess, you know, Christelle, let's start with you. I mean, so with the new extension, what does this mean to you? And what things are you telling your clients about what this news means for them?
Yeah, for me, I think manufacturers took that as probably good news, but for me, I can see it as a bit of the poison apple. So yeah, it means you've got more time, but more time means also more risk. So at the moment, like Notified Body, I've been telling manufacturers for months that they've got availability and they're waiting for manufacturers to give their technical file. It's true now, it might not be through if manufacturers wait and take the whole length of the possible extension period. You have to remember as well that this extension is for legacy devices only. So any new devices will not be concerned by the extension. And it comes with a few things that you need to do. So you need to have a QMS in place.
Okay.
You need to, if you already need to be compliant with the IVDD, and if you make changes, then you probably won't be allowed the extension. So there's a lot of things that you have to think about before thinking you can have a break and enjoy the extension time.
Okay. And Warren, what about you? Do you have any additional input or things that you're hearing or telling your clients?
Well, exactly the same as what Christelle is saying. You know, when we saw the last proposal kind of come in, Christelle and I were presenting at RAPS and we were in last year, 2023, and we were talking to notified bodies, and the conversations were, please, we have time now. We have mobility to work with you. But we saw from those same conversations that notified body applications dropped by half. So like to Sud, BSI, wow, we're all saying the same thing, that the applications per month nearly halved in one go. And we're seeing a lot of the large manufacturers have got onto the IVDR bandwagon quite early and they've started that transition. So they're now in their post-market phase. You know, they are doing the PMPF studies, they're doing the PMS, their post-market surveillance surveys. They're, you know, they've got their plans issued and are now starting to generate even some PMSRs or PSURs based on their classification. But we're seeing the medium-sized companies, even there is a few larger companies that are still very much, oh, we've got time now. And we're now going to push that down the line, or we're going to just have it rethink our resources a little bit too. And I think we've all seen from the market that, you know, with post-COVID, we have seen that there's a lot of changes and reassertment of what is a priority and what devices are a priority. Mm-hmm. But I also think even with the extension, this 2.5 years extension, so, you know, the proposal kind of said it has pushed forward that set of 2025 that we've been seeing, which was the original extension for Class Ds, it's now going to be 2027, 31st of December 2027, from moving from May 2025. Class Cs, 31st of December 2028, and Class Bs and Class A stars 2029, 31st of December for those as well. I can see why that extension can't put in there. You can see where the clients, especially the Class D manufacturers who were struggling to move the new class, well, I'll rephrase that again. The new Class D manufacturers versus the already Class D manufacturers that were under and were either List A or List B devices under the IVDD. They had a tech file in play. They've already been to the notified body, so it wasn't there. You know, you see those jumps, but then the common specifications came out last year that are being adhered to. You need to be, I think this year, July 2024. Yeah, you can start to see the pressures now forming for those manufacturers. So I can now see at that time when the proposals were extended, was pushed forward, Class D manufacturers had the average 12 to 18 months from submission of their application to the notified body to their certificate being issued. Yeah. So if you were seeing in January there of this year, you've got what, before this proposal was brought forward, that was 15, 16 months. So January 2024 to May 2025, that was the deadline was left on Class Ds. And then you had common specifications coming into play this year that you had to be in compliance with. And there was a 2-year transition for those. Okay. So Class D manufacturers were the struggle there. I love it.
So I've got two things. So first off, so again, Class D, those are the highest risk IVD devices, yes. Right? Okay. And then the second thing, so you're saying it, you know, there's quite a bit of delay from submission to approval. Are the deadlines the submission deadline date or the approval deadline dates? So when you were saying, you know, December 31st of, you know, whatever year, is that when they need to have their product submitted, or is that when they need to be approved by to be able to continue to sell on the market?
That's a good question. I would go with certificate.
Okay.
I think
certificate,
there is,
I guess. So sorry.
There is a level of overlap, you know, that if you've submitted, and there's a little bit of gray area kind of forming there too, a little bit, because there is in it with devices that are going submission, but if their certificate's expiring, which is probably a good conversation in a moment for some of these devices as well. We're seeing another reason for the transition is because between 2022 and 2025, we were starting to see some certificates under the IVDD expiring as well.
Okay.
Which was then putting a pressure, so they don't have a new issued certificate. They didn't have transitioned over the IVDR. They couldn't sell in Europe anymore. So there's a few caveats to that as well, where there is a conversation with, if you have gone to a notified body for your IVDR and your certificate has expired, there is a conversation where a notified body can take that on. So it means you're not pulling out of Europe, even though your certificate has expired, because you're in that transition phase. There is a few things there, but the numbers that were kind of forming with certificates starting to expire was kind of the clear concern. So just to my left here as a reminder, in October of 2022, there's 1,551 valid certificates issued by the notified bodies from under the IVDD. So with this transition, the fear was, and we're starting to see certificates are beginning to expire. So 30 had expired in 2022, 165 in 2023, 482 are expected in 2024, and 866 in 2025. So that's where we have another caveat on this proposal. Yes, it pushes forward the extensions to this, you know, to allow these devices to stay on the market for longer. But also there is a caveat of a rule that you have to give 6 months notice if you're pulling out any of these devices from the market, or you're going to start stop selling components from that.
So what's the purpose of that? I mean, what does that do? Is it just allow the competent authorities a time to be able to help find alternative, you know, alternative devices, or yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, completely. It's a mixture of they don't want the certain devices and, you know, supply certain devices, especially high risk ones or orphan devices, to be shut down or to be interrupted. So they're trying to control that by having an up change of Article 10A, if it goes forward, that you have to then tell the competent authorities and tell your customers. And your distributors, etc., that this interruption is going to have happening 6 months in advance. I don't know how well established that's going to be, because that's kind of a very balancing act of supply in the market versus commercial business decision. So it's a very, I'm sure there's a line in the sand. But yeah, it's there. And you can see where the fear and the pressure is for these types of manufacturers to not stop supplying. And I can see then, that's what we're trying to swing all the way back around to your original question. That's what we're trying to talk to our clients about, is you are in the middle of this transition. The transition has been extended, but that doesn't mean you take your foot off at this point in time. This is the time where you should be getting all your documentation together in a row. You should be getting all that data that you're trying to find. If there are claims that either weren't strongly supported in the past, or they have evolved over time. We have seen in reviews of IFUs that under the IVDD, some clinical performance claims were not backed up for actual clinical performance data. It came from evolution of literature, but it was never actually how the intended purpose of the device in the beginning. So we've seen that evolution, where now this is an opportunity for manufacturers to kind of take a step back and go, okay, I need to push this forward. I have a bit more time to do it and to do it properly. And also, I can now maybe put in that time and effort into that post-mortem group performance follow-up study that could get me that new information that we need.
I would say it's more than an opportunity. It's a necessity, because I think there was some pragmatism from notified body up to now that would look at file, and they were a bit more, not lenient, but they would look at the performance data in not such a stringent way. But now, as their learning curves has gone up and they're getting more and more device certified, they're having as well a more stringent view on the clinical and performance data.
Okay.
And it's going to be, I think, more and more difficult for manufacturers who would have weakness in their performance data to get a certificate. And coming back to your question about the transition date, I think this is something that manufacturers, and especially those who are not used to work with notified body, have to consider, is that when you look at the end of the transition, it's not actually the date till you can work out your certification. You have to keep in mind that to get a certificate, once you've sent your technical file for review to a notified body, it will take between 12 and 18 months to get a certificate if all goes well. So you have to think backward as well from the end of the transition date. How long do you still have to get your technical file ready? And it's actually not that long, if you think. You can't think over the whole extension period. And you have to realize as well that some technical files are refused right away because there's not enough data, there's missing documentation. And then that would add delays. So I think manufacturers have to be very careful when they look at the dates. It's not actually that far, because if you work backwards, like 2025 is actually, if you count 12 or 18 months period to get a technical file reviewed, you have to send your technical file like almost right now.
So Christelle, let me ask you a question. So as with your regulatory hat on, what have you seen have been the biggest hurdles for your clients getting to IVDR compliance? Like, you know, what's the most time consuming things that have been delaying them? Is it just getting the records in place, or is there a lot of retesting that they're having to come up with? Is there a clinical issue? I know from the MDR, I think the clinical requirements were a bit overwhelming for a lot of people moving over. What about with the IVDR?
Yeah, I think in some extent it's about the same thing, and you can learn a lot from the MDR extensions. So for IVD manufacturer, the other hurdle is that lots of them haven't been dealing with notified body before. So although they have all the records, they don't have the structure for technical files, maybe not quite ready. So they need to get that around, get the new structure for the technical file, get all that data together. Most of the time they have the data, but they don't always know they have it, or they don't always realize where it is. So it takes a lot of time to get everything all together. I think for legacy device, very old legacy device that have been on the market for a very long time with the IVDD, there's really old data. They're not all up to the standards. I would say that manufacturers that came early into the IVDR transition could leverage those data and take action, saying that they will complete those data through PMPF studies and things. I think the more you wait, the less you'll be able to do that. So you would have to have really good, strong data compliant to all standards when you apply to a notified body now.
And
so
PMPF stands for?
It's the post-market performance follow-up. So it's the equivalent of the PMCF studies for the MDR.
Okay, thank you. So you said something when I was trying to convince you guys to come on and do this podcast, we had a little conversation, and you guys brought up the subject here, what lessons have we learned from the MDR? And you kind of mentioned that as well. So, you know, what are some things that we've learned from the MDR that you guys are using to help your clients with the IVDR?
What I'm seeing from the MDR side of the coin has been, well, one, the PMS. Most manufacturers at this point in time, from the IVD standpoint, we've dealt with in the past have either been 13485 manufacturers or equivalent have a QMS in place. What we're starting to see now from the MDR side of things is that a lot of these manufacturers have not got a QMS that would stand up to the MDR, especially in their post-market surveillance. As we know from the original issue of the IVDR and the transition that was put into play, with certificates and everything were still extended out, certain aspects of the IVDR are already in play, post-market surveillance being one. And we're seeing, on the MDR side, we're seeing clients who are not up to date, who are only starting to put PMS plans into play now, PMCF surveys, strategies, etc., in this moment in time, and they've been going a little bit longer than IVDR has. So we do see that. We're also seeing, because of the extension, this little bit of overconfidence or lack of reply, where even most recently we've had clients reaching out to start making, they haven't got a notified body, they haven't signed up a contract yet. The deadline for that's coming very, very soon for the MDR. And you know, they haven't made that effort. As we've said here, the transition is there, but there is some caveats that we need to play, and that you as an IVD manufacturer need to start making these conversations for contracts with a notified body. Also have a QMS in play that meets Article 10. I am not saying that you need to be 13485 compliant. It helps. It's a harmonized standard to the QMS or for Article 10, but it doesn't cover everything. It's not a be-all and end-all. As you've probably seen from the equivalent when we're talking about the QMSR for US, everyone hangs their hat on 13485. But if we look through the recitals, look through the preamble for the QMSR, there's caveats and differences that differentiate from 13485. So there is a few things there going back to it all, we do see clients who have got a little bit lax. We see manufacturers who have got a little bit lax and realize that, oh no, the deadline's now approaching, but they haven't been making the effort before that. Mm-hmm. And now they've still got that risk of falling out because they haven't gone to a contract for a notified body. They haven't been getting their QMS in place. And those were just the basic prerequisites, not even the clinical data, the PM, the CF studies.
Yeah.
There's a stress ball forming there too, though.
Yeah. So a comment and a question. So first off, the comment, I mean, I've never done self-promotion here, but two episodes ago, we had Matt Royal and Paul Risbro on talking about effective communication with their notified bodies. So you brought this up that there's a lot of clients that have not dealt with notified bodies yet. And so this is their first time. So, you know, if you want to learn more about how to work with your notified body, listen to that episode. Now I'll see if that gives a little spike. But I guess the question I have is, you know, Warren, it's been almost a year since we last talked. Are there any more notified bodies now than there were a year or 2 years ago that are supporting IVDR? Or is it pretty much the same group and they've just increased their, you know, their headcount to deal with the pressing needs?
At this moment, I believe there's 12. At this moment in time, there's 12 notified bodies as opposed to the 41 MDR notified bodies. So you can see the different, the complete level capacity difference. That's straight crazy. Away.
That's a huge difference.
And the estimation then is that there is, they think from the transition from MedTech Europe and the most recent MDCGs and the proposal itself and the surveys they've been carrying out, they're expecting about 15,000 certificates for IVDR.
So when you do the math,
if you do the math from the numbers from October, I know there's a slight update. Most recently, I don't have it offhand, but as of October 2023, there's 1,378 applications for conformity assessment. There's 677 certificates issued by notified bodies. Out of those, Class Ds were only 335 applications and 117 certificates were issued. And that's concerning because they think there's going to be, there's about 1,000 Class D devices alone in Europe, and they're expecting about 15,000 certificates from transition over from IVDD, from going from self-declared IVDD to certificate issued IVDR. And there
you know, 667.
Yes, I will indeed. Yeah. But that's, I'm sure it's probably closer to 1,000 now, but it's still far short of where we are.
Yeah.
And then you think of, you've got these two and a half year proposal extension, and then you've got the 15,000 certificates that need to be issued.
Yeah. I mean, I've been with NAMSA for 10 years. I joined this group because I have a passion. I want to help. I want to see new therapies in the market. I want to see technology at its cutting edge, and I want to do anything I can to help, you know, keep the foot on the gas. And I feel like everybody I've worked with at NAMSA has always felt the same. I mean, we're in it because we want to get these technologies to market. Either we have our own personal stories or we know the impact. And of course, you know, we also want to make sure that our clients are making the best possible product that they can make. But there are some things that I feel like, you know, in our industry, we kind of overhype to try to drum up business, but I really hope people realize that this is something that's got to be taken seriously and that, you know, at some point in time, they got to stop kicking the can down the road for the IVDR. I think it was an important change. It's a huge challenge, but I think it was proven fairly easily that, well, not easily, but it was proven that, you know, under the IVD or in the MDD, there was just a little bit too much exploitation of the information that you provided. But, you know, with the IVDR and the MDR, it's really upped the game. I think the products that are coming out that are compliant with those are, you know, have really proven themselves. I mean, we're doing as much preventive work as we can now for these technologies. Mm-hmm. But well, so, yeah, go ahead.
No, just to put that, for me, I always try to put this in perspective. Well, one, I want to make a caveat. I made a mistake. There's 43 MDR notified bodies, not 42. Okay. Just to correct myself, I just remembered about the last one recently in December. But if you think of comparing the US to Europe, and I'm sure we see probably quite often it is comparisons are being made. One of the things that if you think of a cancer diagnostic or a CDX companion diagnostic for submission to the US, you're talking a PMA, a pre-market approval. big, you know, lots of money. It's a big application, or at the very, very, you know, I'm sure the conversations you've seen recently where the FDA has introduced, they may do a declassification of certain devices, you know, into class two de novos. But overall, they're still being reviewed by the FDA. There's still an approval review process. Under the IVDD, there's cancer diagnostics, there's CDXs that never seen a notified body. So there's your difference straight away. Now these are class C devices. All of a sudden, they're being reviewed by a notified body. And we've worked with, you know, manufacturers of CDX devices, and and there's obviously a caveat to that that goes to a notified body, but also goes to the EMA as a part of the review process for that, for a companion diagnostic. But some of the ones we've worked at are hundreds, if not thousands, of pages of technical documentation we've had to put together for big multiplex assays. So you think of the timeline, the cost of putting all that data, all the bridging studies and the original clinical data, and then all the preclinical analytical data all into one submission. That's one device for one manufacturer. It takes a lot of time. And this is where I think, as Christelle pointed out, a lot of these manufacturers were self-declared devices. So they had monthly 485, and they registered with competent authority. And that was really it. Mm-hmm. And now all of a sudden they're getting this deep dive into their QMS and this deep dive into their files. And now it is it's a big consumption all of a sudden. And then you got, you know, I'm sure we all know from regulatory affairs, it's not a big group. We're not a big group of people. I'm sure we all seem to know each other in some way, shape, or form from all the different manufacturers over the years. And it is a very limited resource. So this is where, you know, Christelle and I have these conversations quite often, and we have these with our clients to not, yes, you've got a bit of time. But this is now the time to be getting your ducks in a row, getting all that documentation aligned. As Christelle pointed out earlier, we've assays that have been on the market for 10, 20 years. Finding that data that they originally hung on to, their IFU, has been a nightmare. I've seen somebody most recently called their old storage warehouse for their data called Iron Mountain, and they have to go and shift the mountain now to go and find their data, which, as a former R&D person, frightens me. If you can't put your hand to a data set quickly, it makes me very scared of where it is in the world.
Yeah.
And so we do see a lot of that. And then the post-market surveillance things. And Rich, you and I have had massive conversations about risk management.
Mm-hmm. My favorite subject. It took us, normally I get to it a lot sooner than 15 minutes into the conversation.
Yeah.
but man, this time just flies by. It's amazing how, I mean, I could talk with you guys for another hour and a half, probably longer. So, you know, I've done a terrible job of plugging my guests, but I've made a commitment saying, okay, you know, you're on my podcast, but you also have other media that you're using to share knowledge and information. So are either of you presenting at any conferences, or have any topics coming up that you're either publishing on or coming up? Christelle, do you have anything coming up?
Yeah, so I'm attending two conferences this year. So I'm going to Berlin in May at the RAPS conference, talking about PMS requirements for UK, okay, because as life wasn't difficult enough for manufacturers, now they have to deal with the new regulation in the UK as well. And I'll be attending RAPS in Long Beach as well later in September to talk about regulatory status of assays used in clinical trials, so okay, LDTs, research use only, or IVDs assays for clinical trials that you take place in Europe.
That's a long flight for you to.
Yeah.
That we'll have to get you there early and let you get refreshed and before you present. And Warren, where are we sending you off to?
I am going to be in Berlin as well. I am doing two talks. I'm doing a solution circle to talk about effective PMS and PMPF and how that can strengthen clinical evidence for the submissions, especially now with the transition in play.
Okay.
How we can take advantage of that to strengthen your technical documentation when you're going into your notified body for your IVDR, even with these transitions in play. And the other one is I'm talking with the head of, with our partnership with the head of IVD at BSI I'm Alex Lan, and we're having a discussion on novel devices and orphan devices under the IVDR. So we're having a little conversation on how you're establishing scientific validity. It's a concept that was introduced in IVDR, especially in a new device, and you're trying to get to Europe where massive clinical evidence and conversation we just talked about. And then if you have a novel device that's, you know, scientific validity usually defined as an analyte in correlation with a disease state, pathological state, physiological state, etc. It's under Article 2 of the IVDR. Okay. But if you've got, if you think of a cancer diagnosis, a brand new cancer diagnostic, brand new marker that you're saying is in correlation with a specific strain of cancer, or not strain, it's a terrible word, the specific type of cancer, how do you establish scientific validity when there's not going to be a lot of literature out there to support it? And that's okay. Through validation studies, etc. So that's what I'll be at Berlin as well. Annoy everybody.
So kind of off topic, but one thing that I learned from RAPS last year, so we got to do a podcast with them and in talking with Matt and Paul. So I heard that RAPS is, realized, hey, people don't like listening to single person talks for 8 hours a day for 3 days. And so you said solution circle. This is kind of their new approach, right? Where instead of just having one presenter, they bring in a couple of experts, and it's more of an interaction with the audience and keeps people more engaged. Do you guys enjoy that format?
Well, I think we've already established from these podcasts, I like to talk. I like to talk far too much. And I have to try and not be rude by over-talking. And I'm probably already infringed on that. But yeah, I enjoy it because it is, when you're in a formal setting on a podium on a stage, it's hard to get that integration with somebody and their situation, talking it through. The best I could equate that to is I did a pre-conference workshop last year with the head of IVD at TÜV SÜD and myself and the head of Reg of Inivata, a cutting edge novel cancer diagnostic company we were working with. And I enjoyed that. It's similar to the solution circle, but it was all day. And it was talking on subjects, talking on those integration points, and they weren't just answering, in 10 seconds and then moving on to the next question. There were big in-depth discussions and processes, etc. So yeah, it's for me who loves to have a chat, I absolutely love it.
And Christelle, are you going to get that format as well, or is yours more presentations?
So the one in Berlin is a presentation, and okay. In Long Beach, I'll be doing a solution circle. It'd be my first one. I've never done that format before. So
yeah, so Matt Royal and I presented a subject idea for RAPS here and on the US side. Then they told us only one of us could go. And I was like, well, Matt's the better looking one and has the better accent. So, but it was fun getting to be behind the scenes and learning how that works. I mean, it can be a bit chaotic because you've got these four or five people that might have never worked with each other. And then, and you got to figure out, okay, how are we going to do this? But I think then once you get everybody in the room, like just like this podcast, it just happens naturally because it's a bunch of people who like talking about this stuff. I mean, everybody should talk about this stuff. But all right. Well, Ann, thank you so much. Every time I do these recordings, I learn so much. It's so much fun talking with you guys. I keep saying it makes me better at my job because I don't get to delve into the IVD world very much, but I learned so much from my colleagues. So you guys were wonderful. Thanks for joining. Warren, we got to get you to that magic number 5, right? So just like on Saturday Night Live, when it's a race between you, Matt, and Paul. So
I must beat them. I must as the target.
And
Drag rights.
I'm always looking for new topics. So, Christelle, if there's ever anything that you want to talk about on a podcast, give me a holler and we'll get you queued up. But I appreciate you taking some time out. I mean, you guys are now well into your Friday afternoon, early evening, and yet you're still here talking with me. So appreciate it. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Rich.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to the RAQA Cafe on the recent announcement of the IVDR extension with our guests, Dr. Christelle Perrin-East and Dr. Warren Jamieson. For our next podcast, we'll be bringing up the subject of human factors planning and testing with Dr. Victoria Barnowski from Swazio Consulting and outside guest, Dr. Quiva Duffy. If you'd like to hear more podcasts on different topics from the RAQA Cafe, please visit us at www.hamsa.com and don't forget to bring your favorite drink.